Wow. Yeah, that was Fastball. The Way, that one-hit wonder. I love that song. The Monkees, before that, Daydream Believer from the Monkees' Greatest Hits. And Jimmy Buffett, Growing Older But Not Up. That's me. I'm Jim B. in for Chris Bricker and beyond. Let's see. I'm sorry about the Hoagie Carmichael song. Something happened to that file, and now it is toast. But I have another Hoagie Carmichael song coming up soon. I know that's one of the things we, Chris and I, have in common, is that we like some of these old tunes from the 30s and 40s. I think, if I look at this correctly, the BOCC meeting is anticipating Dr. Allison Berry. Oh, there she is. All right.
Good to be here to join you all. Thank you for having me. So today we'll primarily focus on respiratory viruses because, as many in our community have likely experienced, we are heading into a COVID-19 surge. So we are seeing a rise in COVID-19 cases nationally and even at the local level. And you've likely experienced that in your friend group. Many people have recently come down with COVID-19. And we are likely to see that get worse as most of our children have now gone back to school. And we're in a different time in the response. So we're not seeing really anywhere near the level of masking that we used to see, and certainly not seeing mandatory masking. So we expect to see more cases out of the kids going back to school. Looking at the data on severity, we are seeing an increase in hospitalizations as well at the national and state and even local level, but nothing like the surges that we've seen in the past. We are seeing an increase, particularly in hospitalizations of people over the age of 70. Locally, we have seen that as well. We've had a total of 10 hospitalizations for COVID-19 in the last month. The vast majority of those, actually all of those, have been in people over the age of 70. And all but one were in people who were not up to date on their vaccines. And so staying up to date in your COVID-19 vaccines is critical, particularly for those of us at the highest risk of severe disease, including all of us over the age of 70 and those of us with significant underlying conditions. Thankfully, though, the character of the hospitalizations we're seeing is very different than we saw in prior rounds of COVID-19 surges. Back in the beginning of this, I was still working in clinical practice, and we would see people of any age coming in with severe disease. And when they got hospitalized, they very often got intubated and unfortunately very often died. That is not what we're seeing now. The vast majority of these hospitalizations are short. They very rarely involve an intubation, and they very rarely move on to death. And so it's a very different character than what we were seeing before. What we're seeing in the hospital right now is mostly people who are elderly and have some underlying conditions, and getting COVID-19 is kind of pushing them over the edge to needing hospitalization, which is still a serious issue that we want to prevent. But I do want to emphasize that this is, even though we're going into a surge, we're seeing a rise in cases. This is not going back to 2020. I am not thinking we're going to overrun our hospitals. I am not thinking we're going to see a massive surge in deaths that we've seen in prior days. But I am concerned about it. And so it's important that we all take steps to protect ourselves and our neighbors. And so that means staying up to date on our vaccines. That means masking if you're in a crowded indoor area, and particularly if you're in a high-risk group, taking extra precautions right now. That means if you're in that group, particularly people over 70 with underlying conditions or people with significant underlying conditions, making sure that you're wearing a good, well-fitting mask when you're in crowded indoor spaces. And getting up to date on vaccines, we'll move into that shortly. I do have, unfortunately, one more death to announce for COVID-19 since the last time we met as KPTZ. We're up to 41 deaths in this response, which is still quite low, but we did lose one more of our citizens in the last month. This was a person in their 80s who was actually unvaccinated. Being unvaccinated is uncommon in our community, but it does happen, and certainly puts one at higher risk of severe disease. So speaking of what's driving this rise in cases and hospitalizations, there are a couple different things. One is that we are seeing Very few precautions. So very few folks are masking. There's a lot more gathering and it's getting colder. So we're moving back inside. And we're seeing the large scale gatherings that come with things like school and return to fall activities. We are also seeing new variants in the mix, though we're still seeing the vast majority of COVID-19 cases in the country and locally are still Omicron subvariants, so the XBB variety, which is hopeful because that is what is in the updated COVID-19 vaccine that should be coming out in the next couple weeks. We are likely seeing also playing into this waning immunity against COVID-19, particularly in our elder population. Those over 65 are less able to maintain their immunity from prior vaccinations. And so we're starting to see that protection fade. Thankfully, we have an updated booster coming out in the next couple of weeks. We're hearing mid-September is the most likely time that that's going to be released. And that updated booster is specifically against XBB, which is what is circulating now. So that is likely to provide good protection, particularly for those of us at high risk, but really for the whole population. We're not likely to see enough come out in the beginning for everyone to have access to that vaccine, but we should have it available for pretty much everybody by around October and those at highest risk by mid-September. And so with that, I'm happy to start with questions from our commissioners and then move into questions from the public.
We do have quite a few questions from the public this week.
And I think that speaks to, you know, what we're seeing with increased cases. It's back on people's minds. And there's a lot of coverage of it, some of which is maybe a little overly scary. I've definitely heard from folks who are scared that we're going back into, you know, fall of last year or fall of 2020. And I don't think that's what's going to happen. But I do think there's more COVID around. We know that by the data that we see. And particularly if you're at high risk, if you're in one of those groups, you can develop severe disease and you can even die. So taking those steps to protect ourselves is very, very important. Thankfully, we have far more tools at our disposal now than we did back in 2020 to keep ourselves safe.
Dr. Berry, do you have the, are we still doing the wastewater surveillance? And can you talk about what that is currently showing?
Sure. So we do still do wastewater surveillance in Port Townsend. So there's some limitations there. We're only covering Port Townsend, doesn't cover South County. But we have seen a rise in cases in the last few weeks in Port Townsend, but not a massive surge. It's gone kind of up and down and up and down. The trick with Port Townsend wastewater surveillance is Port Townsend is also a tourist town. And so we see new surges of people arriving in Port Townsend who are also using our facilities. And so that likely leads to some of the bumpiness in the cases that we see in Port Townsend. But it's not, when we look at the increase, we see an increase, but it doesn't look anywhere near the size that we've seen in prior surges, at least so far. I do expect the number of cases to increase in the coming weeks because there are a lot more connections happening right now as many of us dropped off our kids at school this morning. But so far, it's not as severe as prior surges.
Thank you.
No worries.
You started it with bringing up schools. I'm just wondering what kind of additional precautions, you know, we need to take for things like school.
Are you still working with the schools?
Yes. So we are still in close contact with the schools. At this point, things like masking are not mandatory at the school level, but there are still precautions in place. So there are still tests available at our schools for kids. It's one of the only places where you can still get free tests. So any child who's sick, the expectation is that they test before they return to school. And if they're positive, they stay out for a minimum of 5 days. And then they have to wear a mask when they return for the next 5. So there's a lot more testing available.
You say test before they return to schools, but very likely the only place they can get those tests is at school, right?
So good question. So it's not usually testing on site at this point. So the schools mostly have home tests. And so they'll send those home with families if someone is ill. And we do still have tests available through the public health department for folks who can't otherwise afford tests. And in South County, that's primarily distributed through our fire stations. So there are still places available. But yes, if you have a kid who is sick, and you can't otherwise access a test, the schools do still have access to tests, and they can send a home test home with you to test that kid out before they come back. So kids do need to stay home when they're sick. especially with COVID around. And then if they don't have COVID, they can come back when they're well. If they're positive for COVID, they have to stay home 5 days and then mask for the next five when they come back. But it is much less than we were seeing before. We're not seeing mandatory masking, and we're not doing the level of contact tracing we were doing before. But with the accumulated levels of population immunity that we are seeing, we do think that this will help protect us. But as a parent, the biggest thing you can do is keep your kid home when they're sick. It's really hard. Having a sick kid is so hard on work. I know that challenge very well in our family, but keeping your kid home when they're sick helps protect everyone else around them, and testing them before they go back to make sure it's not COVID. COVID in children can look like a mild cold. And so anytime your kid is sick, you do still need to test them before you send them back to school. The main reason for that is because there are other kids in that school who have significant underlying conditions. We have kids who are going to school who have leukemia, and we want to make sure and protect them. And we want to make sure and protect the other people in their houses as well. And knowing how difficult it is to have a kid who's sick and home, we don't want to share that with all the other parents in that room. So if we can keep our kids home, that makes a big difference. Certainly, we encourage masking, but it's hard to get a kid to mask when the other kids around them are not masking. But I think it is worth having a conversation, particularly if your child is high risk, having a conversation with their classroom, with the other parents who have kids in that class to encourage safety around your child.
Dr. Barrett, can I follow up on that? You know, when I lived in Asia years ago, it was just normal if you had a little bit of like the sniffles or something to wear a mask to do source control as you went to school. And I guess as we have, you know, I mean, attendance is a real issue at schools, you know, since COVID as well, you know, and being able to string together a successful school year is really incumbent upon that is actually going to school. So if you've tested your kiddo and they don't have COVID, but they do have sniffles, would you say still keep them home or try to be like the cool kids and wear a mask to school? I mean, our cool commissioner is wearing a mask today.
Yeah, I think that's a really good option. If you are, if you're very ill, you've got a fever, you're really sick, you do need to stay home and rest so that you can get better. But yeah, if you have mild illness, mild sniffles, and you're negative, wearing a mask could be a good way to stay in school. And that's even what I do. If I'm feeling a little off, and I'm testing negative, but I don't feel severely ill and I still need to go to work, I wear a mask and go to work because I know that I can protect the people around me by doing that. Especially for those in our community where staying home is not an option for you. Not everyone has the flexibility to stay home from work. So if you have to go to work a little bit ill, wearing a mask can protect the people around you as well. And yeah, be one of the cool kids, protect your neighbors, and take care of the other kids in your class, because we all want to be able to stay in school. And when we're talking about school and COVID, I think it is good to address also, sometimes there's fears that we might close the schools again. That's not on the horizon. We don't think we're going to do that. It would take a true disaster for us to do something like that. And I don't think that's going to happen here. What we could see, though, is if we see really marked absenteeism of teachers. So if all the teachers get sick and they can't staff it, you could see classroom closures related to that. So the best way to prevent that is to not share our viruses at school so that we can all keep going to school this fall.
Same goes for workplace too, right?
Yes, please. Absolutely. You know, everyone is short-staffed right now after the last few years. There are a lot of different things driving that, including COVID and how many people we lost to COVID who were caregivers and how many people developed long COVID after the last few years. So knowing that nearly every business and government office is short-staffed right now, being cautious to not share illness is a good way to keep everything open.
Cool. All right. So on to the listener questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got a few COVID questions. One was particularly around boosters. So questions about the upcoming booster this fall. So the upcoming booster is against XBB specifically, and that is far and away the most common variant that we're seeing. If you look at the breakdown on the state website, you might see a lot of colors, but if you look at the key, they're all variations on XBB. They're XBB 1.5, XBB 1.6, just all XBB, which means this upcoming booster should have very good coverage against what's been circulating for the last year and is circulating now. So as soon as it becomes available, I would encourage everyone to get it, but save it for those at highest risk for the first couple weeks. So if you're over 65, you have underlying conditions, go out and get that booster as soon as possible. If you're immunosuppressed, go out and get that booster. If you are any of the rest of us who don't meet those criteria, we recommend waiting until about October so we can save availability for them.
I'm hoping caregivers get added to that list.
Fair. If you're taking care of someone who's particularly high risk, I think it's very reasonable for you to get your booster too, because that's a really good way to protect those at highest risk, particularly the group that we know who has continuously been at the highest risk of COVID-19 is people undergoing chemotherapy. So people with cancer who are getting treatment, caregivers of those in that group, I think should also get their boosters as soon as possible to protect them. And when we're seeing
workers of caregivers too, right?
Not quite that far, but masking up when we're all together, I think would be a good idea. We have a public health staffer who's been caring for her husband with cancer throughout the pandemic. And so whenever we have a meeting with her, we all mask up. And that's just an understanding we have of how we protect her. And I think the more that we can share our situation and take that into account, the better we can all get through this surge. The other question about that was, that I hear is, do we get the currently available booster right now, or do we wait for the new one? And at this point, the new one is coming so soon that I would wait. So if you haven't gotten your bivalent yet, I would wait for the new one. It's coming out in a couple weeks. If you recently got your booster, I have one of the questions was someone got boosted in June. So when should they get the new one? And the answer is as soon as it comes out. You have to have 2 months between your boosters. And so if you got it in June, you're good to go to get one now. Another good question was, what is an underlying condition, which is a phrase I've used a lot so far, so it's good to define. What counts as having an underlying condition that puts you at risk of COVID and severe disease? And there are a lot of things that count as an underlying condition. This family particularly referenced hypertension, that counts, and cardiac disease. One of the family members had recently had cardiac surgery. Having recently had cardiac surgery is a significant underlying condition, which puts you at serious risk of severe disease from COVID-19. In my family, I have a family member who had cardiac surgery in the midst of the Delta wave. And ever since then, we've been very, very cautious to not share COVID-19 with him. Having heart disease really is one of those risk factors that puts you at serious risk of COVID-19. So if you have either of those things, you count as having an underlying condition that we want to protect you. There are many, many things that count, but think of lung disease, heart disease, immune system diseases, which includes any kind of medication you're taking that reduces your immune system function, neurologic diseases too. So people with MS, people with history of stroke, that puts you at high risk of severe disease as well. Those are the big ones that we worry the most about. Those are the systems that really go down when it comes to COVID-19. And of course, any kind of cancer treatment that someone's undertaking puts you at significant risk as well, or just having cancer is an immune modulatory experience. All of those are the folks that we really, really want to protect coming into the fall. And remember, you can't always tell who's in that group. We talk a lot about people over 70, but there are lots of folks under 70, people under 65, who have those conditions and you don't know. One of the ones that you really can't tell is someone who's immunosuppressed in front of you. So if you see someone who's wearing an N95 in the grocery store, there's probably a reason for that, and take extra caution around them. You don't know anyone's life story, either who they're taking care of or their medical issues. And the more we can all take care of each other as we move into the fall, the better we're going to do. And I think that is something that in Jefferson, we've done quite well in recent years. I think we got to keep that energy going so that we can do well through this next surge. Let's see, what else? One was they shared an article, it was actually from 2022, that they wanted us to talk about a bit on this program. And it referenced, in that article, they talked about a really good study out of the Yale School of Public Health that looked at how many deaths were prevented by COVID-19 vaccines. And what they found with their modeling was that between 2020 and the end of 2022, COVID-19 vaccines saved 3.2 million lives in the United States and prevented 18.5 million hospitalizations during that time. So they're highly effective, made a huge difference at keeping people alive. They could have kept even more people alive if more people got them during that time period in the United States. Thankfully, in Jefferson County, we had very high uptake in vaccination. We have the second highest rate of vaccination, or sorry, third highest rate of vaccination in Washington State, with 84% of our population vaccinated. And we have actually the highest rate of folks who are up to date on their vaccines, which is just under half of us are up to date on all of our vaccines. That means there's still a good half of our population that could use to get up to date. And I would recommend doing so when we get this updated formulation. But the amount of folks who got vaccinated in our community was a huge driver of our success in the pandemic. In that article, they also talked a little bit about some of the vaccine misinformation and confusion around vaccines. Thankfully, I haven't heard a lot of vaccine misinformation lately, so I'm hesitant to wade back into that right now. But one thing that they talked a bit about was something called the base rate fallacy. So if you are seeing conversation around vaccines, one piece of misinformation you would sometimes see is people citing that the same number of people are dying who got vaccinated as those who didn't, or even sometimes more of the people who are currently dying are vaccinated than are not. And that has to do with something called the base rate fallacy, which is, as we just said, 84% of Jefferson County has been vaccinated, which means the vast majority of us are vaccinated. And that that group tends to skew older. So more of our elderly population has been vaccinated. Those two things together are what drive that shift. When you see, if the vaccine really wasn't doing anything, you would see that 84% of those who are dying right now were vaccinated, but that's not actually true. As we talked about, for those who were hospitalized, the vast majority of those are unvaccinated, even though that's a teeny tiny fraction of our population. They are disproportionately represented among those who are hospitalized and die. So the data is super clear. The last time that we were looking at differential hospitalization rates, you were 15 times as likely to die of COVID if you were not up to date on your vaccines as someone who was. And so it does really make a huge difference. Important to stay up to date on those vaccines, both for yourself and for others. When you're up to date on your vaccines, you're less likely to get COVID and give it to other people, and you are less likely to get severe disease yourself. And that was all the COVID questions. And then I had an RSV question as well from the public. Any other COVID questions from the team in the building?
I think we're good. Please continue.
All right. So RSV, we talked a bit about RSV on our last meeting and some of the new tools we have available to fight it. And so one of the most important things that we have available now is an RSV vaccine. But there are three different products on the market, and I think there's a little bit of confusion about those three. So the first two are regular old vaccines. They're what's called a protein subunit vaccine, just like the vast majority of any other vaccine you've ever gotten, flu vaccines, things like that. And they are recommended for people over the age of 60. People over the age of 60 are more likely to get severe disease from RSV. We talk a lot about RSV in very little kids, which is a very true and serious issue. But if you look by the numbers, more people get hospitalized and die of RSV in our elder population than anyone else. And so it is recommended for people over the age of 60. And it's just a regular vaccine. I think what this person was confusing it with, which is called Synagis. And that is a monoclonal antibody that we've had available for very high-risk children for quite some time. But the vaccine for people over 60 is just a regular old vaccine. There is also a vaccine for RSV approved for pregnant people between the ages of 32 weeks and 36 weeks gestational age to protect their baby when they're born from RSV. That's a really good option because RSV is incredibly dangerous for newborn babies who are too young to get vaccinated. The other tool we now have in our arsenal is a new monoclonal antibody for littles. That is one called nirsevimab. And it's actually just a one-time dose, and it looks like a vaccine. It's just an injection. Synagis, the old version, did take multiple doses over time. It was very expensive. It was very difficult for families. And so nirsevimab is likely to replace Synagis. Nirsevimab, the monoclonal antibody, is now approved for all newborn babies and infants up to the age of 8 months going into their first RSV season. And it's also approved for high-risk toddlers. So toddlers who have significant cardiac or lung disease, premature kiddos going into their second RSV season. All of these are now approved. Not all of them are yet available. The RSV vaccines are available now. There's a lot of wrangling right now to figure out insurance coverage. They're currently covered under Medicare Part D. So if you have Medicare Part D, that should be a covered service for you. But that does leave out a lot of folks who only have Medicare Part B. And that is a frustrating policy issue from our perspective. We would really like them to cover these critical vaccines for everyone. But right now they're only covered under Part D. Nirsevimab is covered under the Vaccines for Children program. And so it should be available to all kids. But the actual logistics of making it available for all kids is going on right now. And I can tell you our colleagues at the state are working very hard to make sure it becomes available for kids in our community, but it's not available yet. We're hoping to have it available closer to October. That, I'm happy to take any other questions or go to Willie, who I think did get a question from the listeners this week.
Oh, wow. We don't want to deprive Willie. We could probably go for another 10-15 minutes though. He's so efficient. Any other questions for Dr. Berry?
Nope.
Okay.
I guess just do we anticipate people being able to get like flu, COVID booster, RSV all at once? Like, you're going to make this easy or do we have to space them out?
Good question. So yes, you can get all of your vaccines at the same time. And so say you're, 65 and have underlying conditions. What I would do is I would get your COVID-19 vaccine and I would get your RSV vaccine at the same time. And I would get your flu vaccine as soon as it becomes available, and it's just starting to become available. So I'd say in the next couple of weeks, you should be able to go in and get all three. For our littlest residents, the most likely way that we'll see nirsevimab rolling out is actually in the postpartum unit. So after your baby is born, if you've had a baby recently, you probably know there's a few different things that they get. There's a hepatitis B vaccine, there's some antibiotics, there's a vitamin K shot, and nirsevimab will likely be one of those as well. So just something that you get as a part of the normal postpartum course of care. And then for those who were born before it became available through their pediatrician's office.
And we expect the kind of the usual, so pharmacies, mm-hmm. Doctor visits, like public health is not planning to do any booster vaccination clinics, correct?
So yes, these are now moving into the normal way that we used to get vaccine before the pandemic. And so that's going to be primarily pharmacies and through your doctor's office. I know most of our doctor's offices are already planning for how to do kind of high volume flu, COVID, RSV vaccines. And so they are putting in plans to do that. So you won't necessarily have to go during one of your visits, but if you happen to go for a visit, then you could have that available. But we aren't going to see the mass vaccinations that we did before at this point. We do, through the public health department, vaccinate kiddos. And so we'll keep doing that. And we will likely still be a safety net provider for folks who are uninsured or underinsured for vaccination. So we still plan to be available for that. Sadly, the RSV vaccine has not been included in that program from the state so far, not yet. So we don't carry the RSV vaccine right now, but we will still plan to be a source for vaccination generally for those who are uninsured or underinsured in our community.
And that would be calling the office and making an appointment.
Yes. Yeah, give us a call. We have a clinic, and we are happy to take care of you at the health department. We are also, I should acknowledge, we are also working with our schools to make sure that there are vaccines available for kiddos further out in our community, not just in our Port Townsend office.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Berry.
Thank you.
All right, Willie, we'll pass it over to you. I think Commissioner Eisenhower has a question for you too. So, you know, don't use all your time on the first question.
Okay, can do. Always a big day when I have a question from the KPTZ listener, so much appreciated. And as the commissioners were talking about a little bit earlier, even though we did have some rain recently, it remains dry, fire hazard remains high. And I think that remains on the minds of our community members as it's reflected in this question. So my KPTZ question was asking, given the recent fires around Lord's Lake and then on Beaver Valley, how firefighters actually fight fires in wildland areas when there aren't necessarily fire hydrants nearby for quick and easy access to a pretty strong continuous flow of water. And shout out to Chief Black as well as Chief McKern with East Chef Fire and Quilcene Fire respectively, who provided a little bit of input into my answer today. And basically, in short, water isn't the only tool in the toolbox to fight fires. Obviously, it's one of the most effective and efficient to put the wet stuff on the hot stuff. But when fighting a wildland fire, often the most effective tactic is to remove the fuel that actually allows the fire to spread. So they will cut brush, cut trees, cut that plant matter that the fire actually needs to survive and thrive and grow further. So they'll cut that plant matter. They'll actually scrape the dirt first with hand tools and then with a dozer later on in what's called cutting line. And so when you hear that a fire has actually been contained, that doesn't mean the fire is completely out, that they've dumped water on the whole thing to put it out. They've actually cut a perimeter around the fire so the fire cannot continue to grow. Oftentimes after a fire has been contained, crews will be on site for several days, if not weeks afterwards, monitoring it as that fire continues to smolder. There's just been a line cut with no fuel, nothing for the fire to latch onto and spread. So it's been, and therefore, in effect, contained. So that's really one of the most powerful tools and powerful tactics for firefighters fighting a wildland fire is to, again, prevent its ability to spread by cutting that line around it. However, water, especially for knocking down fires, putting out fires on approximately less than 6 feet or so, obviously is still very essential. Firefighter, their apparatus can carry, you know, up to 1,000 gallons of water or so, but they do carry tankers. They do have those as part of their fleet that can carry about 1,000 to 5,000 gallons of water. And so they will often call in mutual aid from other areas to bring in additional tankers, get additional water on site that way. Then obviously, like we saw during those two local fires, eventually they, during larger fires, they may get helicopter support to bring water and dump that on the fire. And they'll often draw from lakes. They didn't draw from Lord's Lake, but rather Lake Leland during the fire out there in Quilcene to help support that. The listener asked if they ever tap into wells, and they don't tap into wells specifically because they can use hundreds upon hundreds of gallons of water per minute, and most private wells simply don't produce at fast enough rate to meet that high demand. So they will look to tankers. They will look to bring in helicopter support for larger fires and on top of, again, cutting line and preventing the fire's ability to spread that way. So excellent question. Really appreciate the listener asking. Really appreciate folks continuing to adhere to the burn ban, exercise caution when grilling, when doing anything like that to help prevent the spread of fires. I will say one question I have been getting asked recently In light of the fire in Maui, was questions about our usage of sirens. The Emergency Management Agency in Hawaii made a somewhat controversial decision not to use their tsunami evacuation sirens to alert folks of the impending wildfire. They were afraid that upon activation of those sirens, the general public's training would kick in and they would evacuate to high ground as if it were a tsunami. However, the wildfire was located in their evacuation route on high ground. So they were really worried that that would send folks actually into the hazard area rather than away from it. So they chose not to activate that resource. The questions remain whether or not that was the right decision. So we'll certainly be looking to see the results of their after action report, likely a year or two down the line. We do have similar tsunami sirens here locally. We have them in the Boat Haven. We have them at Point Hudson and Point Wilson in town. And those really aren't for wildfire notice. Those are specifically for folks outdoors in the immediate vicinity to alert them of an impending tsunami. Since they are located on low ground where people congregate outdoors, may not have access to a cell phone, access to a radio. They may specifically in some of the Point Wilson and Point Hudson, they may be tourists and not know of local resources or subscribe for Nixle or things like that. So those are for a very specific purpose, not for general broadcasting of, something like a wildfire evacuation. Those sirens would be pretty useless for the folks in Beaver Valley, in Quilcene, things like that. So in case of a wildfire, we'd use the integrated public alert and warning system like we did during the Beaver Valley evacuations. That's the push notification on your phone, similar to an Amber Alert. That also activates radio as well as broadcast television alerts. We'll use Nixle, which is our subscription-based system. Social media, our partners at KPTZ and KROH, and really the general public, helping neighbors, helping to notify their neighbors. That's really what NPREP is founded upon. So you might get that alert. Check in on your neighbors as you're evacuating or as the situation is developing, especially if they have unique needs that may require a little bit of extra assistance. So I've been getting that question a lot lately. Happy to talk more about that one-on-one with folks if you shoot me a note, or we may talk about that through NPREP a little bit more since the siren issue has been a big concern here for quite a while. Other than that, that is all from me. I know Commissioner Eisenhower potentially had a question. Other than that, happy to take any more.
Well, actually, it's more of a report to you, Willie, that we did have our first neighborhood block party, and we did collect contact information and email and cell phone information for, 20 households in our neighborhood. But there, the question from there is, how do we get more coverage? I mean, how many block parties? So we thought maybe we'll have a block party every year, but, it would take a lot of years to get complete coverage of all the neighbors in the neighborhood. So I was thinking something like having neighbors who signed up to reach out to, the closest neighbors around them and build kind of pods and then have them get the contact information to build the list. But I don't know if you've seen any great strategies for fleshing out your neighborhood contact list.
Yeah, no, that right there is an excellent strategy. Kind of grow, creep outward and outward, using the most recent neighbors you talk to. Feel free to contact us, and we can connect you with the NPREP leadership, who have, some of them have 10, 15 years of experience growing their neighborhoods. I will say, more than anything, it is a big time commitment and it can be a big resource commitment trying to get folks on board. So more than anything, you mentioned it might be a couple of years and a number of block parties to get everyone. That really is the most effective strategy, is keeping at it, letting folks know that you're here, we're here to help you, come and join us, and eventually you'll get everyone. But in the meantime, I like your strategy of, trying to recruit new folks to help recruit additional folks and kind of grow it. I don't want to say like a pyramid scheme, but it almost is that. Feel free to contact us, and our NPREP leadership is more than happy to help.
I would just say the neighbors who did come were pretty excited that we were, getting connected in that way, and the idea of having a community contact list. So I, think that we'll move ahead with, organizing our neighborhood, but I appreciate the inspiration from the NPREP information that's been shared over the last couple of years. And it's taken a while, but I feel like we took a great big step forward. So it's good.
Awesome. Well, thank you and congrats.
Great. Are you sure it was Lake Leland they were taking the water out of, the DNR helicopters? I mean, it was a grim sight to see those helicopters going, but you know, we were, you know, down there watching and we thought they were going over from us from the north, but I don't know.
It was my understanding they weren't going to pull from Lord's Lake since that was the drinking water for us here in the city. But my understanding was that they were going to Lake Leland instead, since that was the closest major water source for them. But I may be mistaken. I'll double check on that.
Largest lake in Jefferson County, of course. So it's reasonable. Great. Well, thank you, Willie. Any other questions for Dr. Berry or Willie on any of the topics we've discussed or any others? We have just a few minutes left.
Not for me.
Okay. Well, we'll let you go. Great to see you, Dr. Berry. Willie, glad you're with us. Good to see you guys. We'll see you next month, Monday the 2nd. So we'll see you back here same time, 9:45 with KPTZ at 9:45 on October 2nd. Have a great day.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, and thanks to the listeners of KPTZ.